We redid our core values as a company. We sort of settled down and we said, here's what we're going to do. And not like, and not you're with us or against us, but like, here's what we're going to do. We're doubling down on these things. Here's really what I want to do in my vision. And if you're not on board for this, this is probably the time to exit, right?
Welcome back to the Impact Entrepreneur Show. My name is Mike Flynn, and I am honored to be your host. Our mission here on the Impact Entrepreneur Show is not just to inspire you, but also to help you tap into and begin to believe in your God-given potential and purpose. That's right, baby. We want you to not only be inspired, but experience breakthrough. And we do that on this podcast by interviewing incredible people who are using their experiences, their skill set, their platforms to have a game-changing impact in the lives of others. And here's the thing. None of these folks are simply sitting back, living a life of leisure. They have things to do, places to go, and lives to impact. Speaking of that, unfortunately, too many of us don't figure out who we are and how we function until well into our 30s and 40s. And let me tell you, as an almost 40-year-old, I can attest to that. But as leaders and entrepreneurs, we actually can change that. We can honor each person in our world. We can highlight and support their unique dreams, hopes, and desires. And when you don't do this, when we forget that our organizations are made up of individual people who have their own vision for their life and their own goals, the results can be disastrous. All you have to do is look at employee engagement worldwide, where 85% of employees are not engaged or actively disengaged at work. And that's resulting in $7 trillion. That's what's costing business in productivity right now, today, in 2019, the most productive period in all of history, supposedly. That's not because most of our employees don't want to be engaged or excel and improve. It's because most employees don't have anyone helping them identify their strengths or use these strengths to improve the organization and move it forward. So this isn't on the employees. It's on the leadership that isn't helping their people find their instruction manual. In Robert's businesses, this comes down to building capacity in people holistically. He needs his people to grow with the business, and that means they need to do more than just work better. The whole person needs to get better. The business sees a tangible benefit from this personal investment in the employees, associates working with the businesses, with becoming and being a better person. I think every company, big and small, needs to focus on creating a culture of personal empowerment through work-life integration like this, like what Robert's doing. Not just work-life integration, but really helping employees crystallize their purpose, their meaning, their potential. One of the things I've begun to say is that, yes, culture will eat strategy for breakfast, but if you don't have purpose, then purpose will eat culture for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then you can throw strategy in there for dessert as well. But integrating personal empowerment into your business will help your business succeed in every level. But it's not even the point. Everyone deserves the opportunity to hone their strengths and contribute to something greater than themselves. And as leaders, that is how we can truly make an impact on the world. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Robert as he shares lessons he's learned along the way and how he and his team are integrating this into their businesses each and every day. And I encourage you to check out his Friday Forward newsletter. That's how I learned about him. You can do that by going to Friday Forward. That's Friday, the word, and then forward, FWD, like the abbreviated version. So Friday Forward, FridayFWD.com, and subscribing to that newsletter, where Robert puts out quick, short, digestible, powerful content each and every week. Bust out your pens and paper, take some notes, and brace for impact. Bob Glazer, welcome to the Impact Entrepreneur Show, man.
Thanks, Mike. Excited to be here.
You know, I was going to kick something off with going right into your origin story and learning a little bit about you, but I actually want to start first with some, like, pulling out some Stephen Covey stuff. And then going back into your origin. And I literally just had this thought as I was setting up my computer and stuff for the interview today. And, you know, Stephen's, one of his primary principles is beginning with the end in mind, right? And I was thinking about my own and how I typically do things. And I think that in general, it's probably a good rule of thumb to begin with the end in mind, to have some sort of a vision. But I also think there is a lot of value in not beginning with the end in mind and just beginning. What are your 5 cents on that?
Yeah, I think it depends on the context and sort of the lens. Like, are you zoomed in or zoom out? So I'm a big fan in some cases, and I can tell you stories in my life of both. I'm sort of just starting. So Friday 4 was a perfect example. If I had thought through the whole thing, I never would have done it. You know, I started it. I kept going with it. I figured it out, you know, along the way. And so that's an example where I think you just need to go. On the flip side, I think when I started to make real changes in my life and my business, it was when I sort of got, when I got really clear on my core values, on what I wanted, on sort of the long-term lens on what my life and business to look mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. and started making choices in those directions. You don't know what all those choices are, and you don't know what that will be. But I literally, before I got on this podcast, I just did our cultural onboarding for a group of 5 employees all around the world. I go through this vivid vision document that we wrote 3 years ago when we were 1/4 of the size of the business. And we said, in 3.5 years, we're going to accomplish all these things by January 2020. And they were crazy stuff. We're going to write a book. We're going to open up in Asia. We're going to open up in the UK. And we have literally hit all of them almost to the time point. So there's something in the universe about telling the universe what you want and where you want to go. You just don't know often, I think, how you're going to get there. And, you know, that document always reminds me about, like, the power of being really clear about where you want to go.
Yeah, that's obviously Vivid Vision. That's a Cameron Harold tool. Yeah. That is he coaching you, or have you worked with him?
He was a coach a few years ago to us when we put that together.
That's awesome. Yeah, he is a great guy and super insightful. He's been on the show a handful of times and been very helpful to me as well.
And it's interesting. So you can imagine these employees are coming on right now at the end as I'm writing the next one. And you know, when I write the next one, they're going to be like, their view of that's going to be very different. I mean, I was joking that my number two told me that it was crazy, like, when we wrote this, and I was ridiculous and we were just gonna let people down. But the credibility we now have having done that makes it a little more possible to kind of, you know, take that next leap.
You know, I think that that's so powerful. And for me, one of the things was that where I didn't have, you know, necessarily an end in mind was when I started the podcast. I just knew I needed to do it, right?
Yeah.
And so I just did it. I started taking action and then, you know, some building blocks. And then I never envisioned writing a book. But then all of a sudden people started asking me, when are you writing a book? So I'm like, I guess I better write a book. And it just, you know, things just started happening. And now, through the process of not actually having an end in mind with the podcast, it's actually provided me with tremendous clarity on some things. And I think that that's one of the values of just playing, right?
Yeah.
Is it creates space for your brain to move outside of the lines.
Yeah. And look, you might not have an end in mind for where does the podcast go, but I'm guessing that the podcast was the solution to sort of a longer term end in mind, or how you wanted to use your time or energy.
Sure. Or a gap that I was feeling I needed in my own life, and where I was, you know, where I was 3 years ago when I started this was kind of in a dry spell creatively, feeling kind of stagnant. You know, my background is that for the last 15 years, I've been in the financial advisory world. Yeah. And our ability to kind of create in that space is somewhat limited very limited because of compliance and all of these things, right?
Yeah.
And I'm a very creative person. I'm a musician. I doodle. I I like to write poetry. I like to write in general. And I'm like, man, I need to find an outlet. And yeah. I want to do it in a way that is going to, where I'm going to get a lot of value out of it and build relationships and provide value to other people. And it's just opened so many doors for me and crystallized things for me in a big way. Like that one of my core reasons for existing is to really help people remember the truth that already dwells in them, which is that, namely, they already possess everything that they need to perform at a peak level in every area of life. And they just need to remember how to go back and get it, right?
Yeah, and I think the more you are in touch with yourself and the person, I mean, yourself and as a person and what you're trying to do, it makes these decisions easier. Mm-hmm. You have clarity about what you want. You know, I think to you and a lot of similar concepts coming out in my next book on how to elevate and build your capacity. But it's all there. But so one of the things I think in life we come out of the factory without our instruction manual, and it's a little bit of a self-actualization where when you reach the point of here's who you are, how you function, how it works well, how it doesn't work well, it becomes incredibly empowering. But I don't think a lot of us get the instruction manual until 30s or 40s, and we start to go through this self-actualization period. And that's when I just seen a lot of people really start to hit their potential. And mm-hmm. and to me, the long-term and the vision and the clarity is around decision-making. Like, because mm-hmm. there's a lot coming at us every day. Do I do A or do I do B? Do I do mm-hmm. C or do I do D? Mm-hmm. So-and-so is asking me for their time. Like you need to say no to 90% of the things, but if you can figure out the 10% of things to say yes to, like your podcast, My Friday Four, the things that matter and help us achieve our purpose, everyone does better.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, you have to, a guy named Daniel Harkavy, who's the author of a book called Living Forward, once told me that you have to say no to good things so you reserve the capacity to say yes to great things. Yeah. Which I love. You know, speaking of coloring outside of the lines and playing, let's go back in time.
Yeah.
Have you always liked your name? When you were a kid, did you like being called Robert Glazer?
I don't. The only reason I don't like my name is that there's too many choices, and a lot of times people use the wrong one. So it just gets, you know, I just wish it was Mark, and it doesn't bother me. But, mm-hmm. but I think anyone has a name who's mispronounced or the wrong version will tell you that they wish there were no choices. So I like my name, but I just wish there weren't multiple variations of it.
Yeah, I asked that because my 11-year-old daughter asked me once, hey, Dad, did you always like your name? And I'd never really thought about it, but then I realized I actually growing up for a good chunk of my life, I'm a junior. So yeah. I'm a Mike Jr. So I didn't like being named after my dad, right? I think it speaks to the whole thing of wanting to be autonomous, right?
Yeah.
And we know that without even knowing it at a young age, we understand the desire, the natural wiring to be independent. Are you named after anyone in your family?
No.
Have you ever asked your parents, why'd you name me Robert?
they just like the name. You know, I've gone, you know, Robert's usually if I was in trouble with my parents or under all my formal stuff or book, but it's usually Bobby or Bob or one of those.
Yeah.
Not Rob or Robbie.
Yeah. Now, are you're originally from Massachusetts?
I grew up in Brookline, if you know
Massachusetts. Okay. My mom's from Chelmsford, Mass. So
yeah, not that far.
Yeah. Now, there's this wonderful quote about curiosity. It says, "Blessed are the curious, for they will have an adventure." When you think back about your childhood and adolescence, teenage years, high school, all that stuff, were you a daydreaming, curious kid, or were you super focused and dialed in?
I was not super focused and dialed in. I was definitely an undiagnosed ADD, you know, creative, hard time in the traditional education system of paying attention, sitting still, doodle, create stuff, ideas. I had a very upper middle class struggle, but I, in talking to a lot of people, maybe similar for you entrepreneurs, you know, they all were in a system that just rewarded conformity, and they were generally not conformists and independent thinkers. And I think it wasn't one of their favorite times to sort of what you're good at not be rewarded. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why there's a lot of late blooming in entrepreneurship, because it's not until you're out of college or doing stuff that people reward the things that you're actually good at. And I don't have a lot of regrets in life, but that is one of the things that I am really on a mission to help other people with. And you know, the charities and spend my time is making sure people, you know, do what they do well and believe in themselves and their own capacity and not follow some standardized, you know, version of success. I'm read a few articles these days, and it'll be the upcoming topic over Friday for how valedictorians really aren't high achievers in life. When you look at it, you know, they check off all the boxes that they need. You can't be great at everything. You have to love something and be bad at something else, right? If you're trying that hard to meet all the boxes, like, you're probably a conformist, and conformists aren't usually super high achievers.
When you were coming up and you were dealing with that kind of juxtaposition of not feeling, you know, part of that system, because I can relate. Did you struggle with identity or sense of worth or value?
Yeah, I think I struggled a lot, and I think I probably didn't. The one thing is, I never had any interest in doing what anyone else was doing. When everyone was in line for Cabbage Patch Kids, I'm like, this is stupid. Like, I never wanted to follow the crowd. I didn't care about being popular. But I think, you know, in terms of teachers and stuff, if I look back at all my report cards, and my mom just dumped them to me because they moved out of their house and gave me all this stuff. It's really interesting. You know, it's like, you know, we think he has more potential. He's not living up to his potential. You know, it's a very consistent theme. But if I flip that, it's like, well, how are you helping me to live up to my potential? Well, when you're talking about potential, you're saying, I'm not using my creativity and out of the box thinking, all this stuff, to fill in the circles and checks on the test. You know, that, you know, so I definitely think that had an impact on me. I didn't associate learning. I associated sort of learning with doing well in school and not learning and learning. And I you know, no one likes to be told they're living below their potential over and over.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because that's a story, a narrative that a lot of people they have it and they wear it, right? Yeah. They take that story, they take that armor on that someone intentionally or unintentionally put on them, and they absorb it and they walk through life with, I'm not living up to my potential, right? But at some point you said, okay, I'm not living up to my potential. Now, what am I going to do about it? What was maybe what was that moment, and who were the people around you that helped you, like, take off?
Yeah. And, you know, our purpose often comes from a point of pain, and probably more often than not. And I would say, you know, anyone who would describe me now would say I am a overachiever. But that's definitely something that didn't start till my 20s. I think I was an underachiever for most of my life before that, which is probably why I'm trying to catch up now. But there were two inflection points for me. The first was going abroad in college, doing an internship, really getting exposed to business and doing business internships, and realize, like, this is something I love and I'm really good at. Again, not something anyone talks to you about as a kid. I was always selling stuff and whatever, but people would say, you know, they'd yell at you. Like, my grandmother shut down a Now and Later reselling candy operation I had when I was 10 years old, taking a train, buying them, selling them in school. And think about that. So in business, no one would reward that. I would reward that if I saw that in my kids. But they'd yell at you and you'd say, shut it down. But if you can kick a ball amazingly at 10 years old, they put you in soccer camps and all this stuff. So I definitely flashed those skills, but I don't think anyone knew them or recognized them, or just you don't reinforce them because that's distraction to doing well in school. So going abroad for me, something clicked where I started to associate business and really started to love to learn. I think it was also the point in college when I had gotten done with my prereq and I could take the classes that I want to take. And basically, you know, that last 2 years of school, I had a 4.0 because it didn't matter how easy or hard the class was. I could take all the classes I wanted. And if I liked the class, I'd get an A in it. Versus it always was really hard for me to pretend to be interested in something that I wasn't interested in.
How do you manage that part now today? Because there's so many people that want your attention, right? And I think that it's a danger that a lot of people fall into is is pretending to be interested. I mean, just like think about Instagram for, I mean, the social media, there's a lot of pretending to be interested going on in marketing today.
I am fairly authentic. I mean, it's probably overly embarrassing sometimes that how much you would know that I was not interested in someone in the conversation at a party. Like the look on my face is like, get me out of this discussion right away. So yeah, I you know, as an adult, I can give myself permission to do that. I'm careful about the people and initiatives that I give my energy to. If something, you know, Derek Sivers had this thing that he said on the Tim Ferriss podcast years ago, it's either a hell yes or a no. And that was sort of his decision factor. And that's sort of how I operate. Like, I don't have to apologize to anyone for not wanting to do something. You know, someone today was asking me about a charity thing and trying to tell me what was a great cause. And I said, look, I've made commitments to help these three organizations this year. I need to give them my attention. Like, taking on one more actually probably delivers a suboptimal output to everyone. Yeah, I'm probably too far on the way of you could know exactly if I was on this call interested or not interested, yeah. But at least I'm you're getting what you get.
Going back to your you know, maybe when you're just getting started in business or even any of your entrepreneurial endeavors, what was your first and or most memorable failure, and what have you learned from it that you still carry forward today?
I have two repeated failures at different phases. I think the first one was I started trying to help other people grow their business, but do that from the outside, and you know, kind of got isolated a couple times with that, and then decided I'm going to start my own business. Like I really just wasn't taking the risks or advocating for the ideas that I was saying, and helping other people do it was not working for me. So that was one. I think the other repeated mistake that I have made and it's a balancing act is that I'm pretty visionary. I mean, I see things ahead. I see around the corner, and you know, not acting on something early enough when I knew it was going to happen. It's like watching the car crash, and a lot of times that's people saying, you know, this person's just not going to work out. But try to convince myself that they would, try to convince myself that, you know, it could get better, but just, you know, not acting enough on what I really knew to be true and trusting my instincts.
Yeah. Have you always had a gut instinct? I mean, it's commonly referred to as the second brain, although a lot of people are now saying that it's the first brain, you know, because you can almost feel something before you can think it sometimes. You know what I'm saying?
I have a good sense of what's going to happen in a lot of scenarios, but it's not black and white. So in a growth company, you know, in a company that grows 20 or 30% a year, which we have done consistently in the last decade, something can go from right to wrong, right? As you say, every time you double, you'll break half your people and half the processes. So it's not that, you know, Mike's a bad employee. It's just, it might be that more like, I can see that like, Mike was a good, you know, controller, but was not going to be a CFO. And I've heard so many people lose money by letting, you know, as that example, say, you know, someone told me they had someone who they knew was not a CFO, and they just, the company was growing 100% a year, and they let it go too far, and they lost $1 million because of a mistake they made. So I think it's more like that, where I can tell where someone had sort of had really hit their capacity limit for what we needed or where it was going. And I saw it coming. The inverse is actually interesting, though, sometimes you can freak people out by seeing too far ahead and saying like, well, Mike's killing it today, but I just know Mike's not going to be the person I need in a year. And if I try to do something about that now, that would make everyone else really uncomfortable because they see that Mike's a high performer, but I'm planning 2-3 moves ahead and I can see that Mike is not my, you know, he's a great director of sales, but he's not my future head of sales. So I've written about that too. I think you have to be a little bit careful. You need to make sure with your team that other people start to see the same signs before you act, or people start to get, you know, you're acting like way before other people can.
So what are the kind of boxes that start to get checked as a team, as an organization. Like in that example, when you're looking out and you're looking at, you're confirming your biases, basically.
I think you just have to be objective around mm-hmm. what it is you're going to be looking for and what it is you're going to need. And what do you have today? And do you believe that that person or that process could morph into that? Because, and look, we've created very unique programs to have honest and healthy discussions with people, find them new jobs. I just think that ignoring reality is not the answer. Like mm-hmm. companies grow. The person mm-hmm. who's a great, you know, 1 to 5 million revenue marketing person is often doesn't want to or not have 10 to 20 million in revenue. And really what they need to do is go back and take that job again and they'll be much happier. But those discussions just don't happen. And then you end up in an acrimonious situation versus something where you can say, look, we need something different. You don't want to do this. So how do we, let's talk about how we get there.
You know, when I was getting ready for this interview and researching you and your organization, one of the things that really struck me is that, yes, you are a rapidly growing company. You've got a tremendous track record, but most of the stuff online about your company and you, it has nothing to do with your amazing year over year growth as a company. It has to do with the culture, the leadership style, the people, the things that you guys do for one another. And so, you know, I want to transition into some of how you've grown as a leader and how your understanding of leadership has morphed over the, you know, last decade or so, and who have been some of the most influential leadership educators in your life as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, and that was, you know, you asked a question before, that was going to be my second inflection point, which was probably now 5 or 6 years ago, as the business was getting off the ground, was starting to get beyond me, and you know, we're building our own leadership programs to sort of follow the same evolution. So I think you go from a doer to a manager leader. You need to get some reps there. You see some best practices and some things you like from other people. And what I would describe was, I think my leadership style at that point was like a patchwork quilt. So I saw some stuff that Jim did and Steve did and this, and I was trying to be each of these people. And I was sitting in a pretty intense leadership program led by a man named Warren Rustan, who's probably been one of the greatest creators of other leaders. I mean, if you want to talk about the definition of a leader, it's not followers, it's they create other leaders. And he was leading this 3-day intense program, and part of that was discovering your core values, sort of who are you before you can lead, be really clear on who you are and what you want, and that internal journey of leadership, and realizing that I really could do so much more and that I didn't have clarity on that. And I worked on that for a while, and that was the hockey stick inflection point of when I came back and I said, we redid our core values as a company, we sort of settled down and we said, here's what we're going to do. Not like, and not you're with us or against us, but like, here's what we're going to do. We're doubling down on these things. Here's really what I want to do in my vision. And if you're not on board for this, this is probably the time to exit right. Mm-hmm. And some people did that. And my leadership style really changed in terms of, again, being from a point of authenticity where I'm just consistent. I tell people my values, what I believe in. Anyone who wants to work with me, I'll be like, this is why you'll love working for me. This is why you hate working for me. I joke around, or I use in a presentation, like to just fly your flag and get the right people. The more you are trying, not pretend, but the more, if I'm trying to, you know, be a tough guy that I'm not, then I'm attracting the wrong people. I'm giving the wrong impression. Mm-hmm. So that really, and Warren's become a mentor and a coach, and really just got me on this journey of kind of authentic leadership, which is, I feel that what I think, say, and do is all of the same thing. Hmm. And if you came to work at AP and you loved working for me, it's going to be for X reason. If you hate working for me, I can tell you exactly why.
What are those reasons?
It's going to be. Which one?
Why would people love working with you, and why would also people hate working with you? And I'm assuming they're probably related.
They're the same.
Exactly.
I push the limits. We innovate. We operate at a high pace. If you love to learn and you want to move quick and you don't want to be bored, you will love working for me. Mm-hmm. If you are someone in life or for a variety of reasons wants to kind of be in a middle lane, or just, you know, as a company, we are always trying to do something better and different. then you will be exhausted by me and will stress to sort of keep up.
That's awesome.
So I'm very clear to people, and you know why people don't work out at our company is because they, and we're honest with them. We say, look, you can read all the stuff about our awards and all the culture and how we respect people and how all of this stuff, but we are a performance-oriented business. We've grown X percent a year. We have high goals. And this will be the fastest paced environment you've ever worked in your life. Mm-hmm. Now, some people are sitting there watching a clock every day and haven't learned anything in 5 years and felt so underutilized. They're just like diving in head and foot. I think other people, it's a real change for them. It's fast. Like mm-hmm. if you're a perfectionist, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You'll get swallowed alive.
Yeah, totally. In an innovative, fast-paced place, perfection is definitely the enemy. And it's like there's this whole mantra that's going on is like perfection is the enemy of good, or good is the enemy of perfect, or something along those lines. And I actually subscribe more to the George Patton approach, which is that a good plan executed violently is better than a perfect plan never executed.
That is one of the quotes on our vision and values doc that I just read 20 minutes ago. You probably know, you probably use all the other quotes, but
that's awesome. Yeah,
so we have a core value of excel and improve. And mm-hmm. we think that excellence and improvement are correlated. It can't be excellent if you've been doing the same thing for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a standard of excellence, but excellence and perfection aren't the same thing. Excellence mm-hmm. means you always try to do a good job. You focus on the weakest link. You do that, but it just won't move forward.
Mm-hmm. You guys have a unique role in your company. I've never read about it anywhere else. A person called the head of culture.
Yeah.
When you brought in the new leadership ethos, did you institute it then? Did you have it already? Like, how did you integrate that into your company?
Well, somewhere in that process, we decided, so culture is responsible for, we broke off the culture from the HR administrative function. So culture sits in its own thing, and things like payroll and benefits and all that stuff, even there's some crossover, sit under finance and administration. And I think that's an important distinction. We outsourced a lot of the sort of mundane pieces of HR. Mm-hmm. So our culture is responsible for, and I play, you know, a big part of that, but finding the right people and keeping them happy and engaged. Mm-hmm. And if we do that, we will have a great product and we will have happy clients. Mm-hmm. So that team is like acquisition and retention mm-hmm. And on the people stuff. And mm-hmm. and everything else is really done by the finance and administration team.
How do you guys go about, you know, with that great culture that you have there? You do a lot of things. You obviously are a performance-oriented, growth-oriented company. But at the same time, you really highlight and speak to and honor the individual person and their gifts and their own, the reality that they all have their own dreams, goals, hopes, desires, because they're an autonomous person, right? And I think that is a struggle today that a lot of companies face. You're probably not immune, but you have more engaged people in your company or they're not there. Whereas Gallup just did a huge study where they have 85% of employees actively disengaged at work, costing companies $7 trillion globally, right? That's a huge number.
Yeah.
And so you have this vision for the company, but you recognize that your company is made up of a bunch of individual people with their own vision for their life. So how do you guys tease that out and do your best at melding the two?
Yeah, so we believe in this concept of work-life integration, not work-life balance, that it is a puzzle or a collection of quality experiences that come at different times. You know, it's not this thing you're trying to get perfect every day. You know, I talk about balance is not being on your computer with a toddler in your lap. Like, no one wants that, right? They mm-hmm. either want good work time or good home time. So one of the things that we have focused on that I think is pretty different, and I would argue to any leader out there, produces a better outcome. And this is a subject in my next book, Elevate. We have focused on building capacity in people holistically. And that is that if we need them to grow with our business, and that if you break half your people, you know, every time you double and half your processes, we want the people to grow with us. So to do that, it's not just about doing the job better. It's about getting the whole person better. If you... Mm-hmm. are tired, exhausted, can't manage money, can't prioritize, like at home, you show up with these same problems at work. So when we talk about Excel and Improve, it is something we promote in all aspects of life. You know, we have paid for coaches for people to run marathons, do things for the first time, you know, try things. We did a whole wish granting thing with Embrace Relationships this year on putting people in touch with people that they hadn't been in touch with a while to kind of repair relationships that were holding them back. And like, I have constantly seen that the people who are doing these things and have meaningful things in their life outside of work, where they're improving holistically, to me is the ultimate win-win. We get the work benefit of it. You know, the person who trained for the half Ironman was doing unbelievably in work when they were doing that, right? Because their brain function went better and their body function was better. So we get the work benefit, but they also get to associate, you know, being a healthier person, being a higher achiever person and parent and stuff with working here. So rather than we celebrate when people are traveling, running, you know, running marathons, taking on challenges, anything that really is in line with our core values, rather than seeing that as an obstacle to their work.
This episode is brought to you by the Lawton Marketing Group, a full-service advertising and design agency specializing in websites, social media, apps, logos, and more. Based in Oklahoma, they work with clients across the nation, from small businesses to large corporations and everything in between. You can find them right now on the web at www.lawtonmg.com or call them at 580-275-2063. Connect with them now for a complimentary, competitive analysis of your website. Just tell them the Impact Entrepreneur told you to call.
Have you ever read the book, The Dream Manager?
Yeah, and we have a dream program here that we've...
I was betting that you had read that book because you help people. One of your big things is you help people make their dreams come true.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a process? Do you follow it? Like, do you have people submit their goals and dreams every year?
If we do a little bit different, there's a guy named John Ratliff who got a lot of attention for doing this in call centers where people would submit into a box. We have a little bit of a different process, and we've done it in line with our big all company event called AP Summit every year. And usually we're doing some theme related to our core values. We're really aligned around that, and we've tied it to that. It is a little more of a collecting preferences, not as explicitly. What happens is we've done some activities around something, but then we've taken that information for a few people to a different level in order to be able to have something happen. But we try to a little bit take more of the Ritz-Carlton approach of constantly understanding our employees, listening, you know, their leaders and culture team, you know, write stuff down or note them so that when we want to reward someone or we want to do something, we have a pretty good sense of that. But there were a few exercises we did where we asked people for very specific things that were important to them. Like this past year's theme was about embracing relationships. And we talked about where in people's lives they need to improve some relationships, or they felt like they wanted to invest more. The year before was where did they need to excel and improve more. And in answering those questions, we found information that sort of led to our version of wish granting.
I love that. So if someone wanted to start small and begin to integrate some sort of a program, what would be the best place for them to start?
I've put together a whole, you know, so many people have asked me about this, that I pulled together best practices. It's probably a book one day because I've now pulled together this kit and email explaining to people how we do it and how other people do it. You could simply ask. You could say, you know, I think if you're a little more, you know, hourly labor, you know, not as white collar, then it works better to just have a box and have like a dream box where people submit things and you can have a committee and you can pull those out and you just reward them. And a lot of times they're not monetary or it's a connection, or they've always just wanted to be on the field of some stadium, or they've always wanted to meet. We had someone whose dream was to teach a college class. And I picked up the phone and called a guy I knew at MIT, and he was so excited to
help.
Gosh.
So
that's a cool. Lot of them were not, and one wanted to be on the board of an organization that supported, you know, something that was going on with her child. And we were able to make that connection. So a lot of times it's not even in monetary. So I would say you can explicitly ask and build a program, or you can just start to you know, listen to your employees, collect these things. And when it comes time to acknowledge or reward them, you know, do it in a different way. And I can tell you, you know, if you pay someone a $2,000 bonus, they will not remember it 3 years later. If you send them with their daughter to visit their 90-year-old grandmother in Greece that they had expressed regret over, you know, and not had met them before, they're going to remember that
forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you bring up such a really powerful point right now, because I think every company needs to do this, big or small. And I was talking with my brother-in-law, who's the controller for a big company, a global publicly traded company. And I'm like, you know, you guys need to develop more in your people, like people development, like not like development for the company's goals, but for their goals, right?
Yeah.
And I brought up a quote that I shared, that I read in some article. I forget exactly what it was, but I'm paraphrasing it. And basically it was a conversation between a CEO and the CFO. And the CEO was saying, we need to implement this kind of a program where we're going to invest in our people and develop them on their purpose and their goals and gifts and dreams and all that stuff. And the CFO said, well, what if we put all that money into them and they leave? And the CEO said, yeah. What if we don't and they stay? And I think that's it's a huge shared outcome. Like that what you're doing right now, even if someone left, you know, the last example you gave was that the family that went to see the grandmother. Even if you did that and then at some point they leave, there's never going to be the likelihood of a bad exit on either part is like basically nil.
It's a small world, and positive alumni, that person leaves and goes and works in our industry or refers people to us. And
totally.
That's why we've had this whole separate program to kind of eliminate 2 weeks notice. Like I think there's a lot of avoidance, and I think email and digital and social has allowed people to, you know, be avoidant in terms of having real conversations. And saying, you, Mike, you know, you've been in this role for a year. We haven't met quota for, you know, last three quarters. Like, is this what you want to do? Do you want to do something else? Can I help you? Like, it's a psychological principle of cognitive dissonance. I need to hold two ideas separate. Mm-hmm. One is that Mike is objectively not meeting the goals that our sales team needs in this role. He's not doing a good job. Two, Mike's a nice guy and I'd like to help him. What happens with most managers, they conflate it. So I start to push you away or be distant because I'm like, I got to fire him. So I got to make him into a bad person because I got to fire him. Versus like, am I in a discussion? Be like, you know what? Thank you for asking. Like, I don't like what I'm doing at all. And I'm like, great. Let's figure out a transition plan. Like, you can start. So why don't you start interviewing? We'll wrap up your stuff. Like, let me know if I can help you. It's amazing what you can do when you're willing to have a real conversation. And again, keep those two concepts separate. And then that goes to I speak a lot about developing a high performance, healthy culture, because I think a lot of places that is mutually exclusive. I have to be able to address objectively that you are not doing a good job at the job that we need done, and that you are a good person that has value probably somewhere else more than here doing that role.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That is so powerful, and more companies need. And that's one of my like objectives too, with the launch of my upcoming book, as well as is to go into corporations and teach them that their people have intrinsic value and they're not looking at it and they haven't even tapped it yet. And it's just deep reservoir of amazing things that is ready for them to tap into.
People get apoplectic when I tell them we have people working here who are leaving. You know, they're interviewing and transitioning, but they're like, how can you let them still work there? You read that disengagement stat. I'm like, how about the people that have quit a year ago and are still at your firm? The devil you know is much better than the devil you know. Like you're telling me because I openly am helping Mike and doing this stuff and letting him work here. When you have another 10 people that are interviewing and lying to you and doing all this stuff, you just don't know about it.
Yeah, totally. What in your role as a leader, what has been the scariest decision that you've had to draw on the most courage to make? Whether it's stepping outside in faith on your gut decision, moving beyond reason into that faith zone, you know?
I think it's letting go of things, you know, letting go of functions, knowing that I have this graph I show the organization as we grow. It's kind of like a flashlight going through a circle. And as the circle gets bigger, the light just covers fewer areas. So I think the hardest thing for everyone is I can't know everything. No one can know everything. I've had to let go of functions. You have to trust people. You have to create accountability. It's hard. You know, leaders, I think, struggle to lead and not manage. So I think I've clearly gotten better at that over time, but just even like giving up finance 3 or 4 years ago, like that's for most entrepreneurs, that is the hardest thing. Like they there's a lot of bad stories that do that, but you can't grow if you don't let go.
You, speaking of growing, I mean, you started out sending a weekly email to your employees. At that time, there were about 30 of them, if I read the article correctly. And just an inspirational message to encourage them and, you know, share your insight or things that you learn. And now that email is growing up to 100,000 plus.
Yeah, about 100,000 people who read it each
recipients.
Week.
I mean, it's pretty gnarly. And that's how I discovered your work. So how do you handle something? You've already got all of the responsibilities and everything that you've got going on, right? And then this thing takes on a life of its own. How do you embrace it? Or what was the thought process as things kind of started to pick up steam with this? Like, how did you fit that into your capacity to say yes to a great thing?
Yeah, it was tough. And I think, you know, success is always attractive in the rearview mirror, right? What you don't see about these things is you do this good work for 2 or 3 years, and then usually it's 2 years, 6 months that the hockey stick. You know, the number of people I have had and sign up in the last 8 months exceeded the first, you know, 3 years probably. So, yeah, it came back to that value thing, which was like, look, I don't know how this fits in. I don't know how I make money on this, but it's just something I like to do. It's helping people. It's so core value aligned. And I'm just going to keep doing a good job at it. And if you read Charles Duhigg's book or The Power of Habit or things around habit.
It's actually on my desk.
Yeah.
I haven't read it yet, but
we're on the same page today. But there's this notion of a keystone habit where there are things like making your bed or exercise or writing or journaling. Then when you develop that habit really well, it actually starts to improve all of your other habits. Mm-hmm. So the exercise of just doing Friday Forward and having to think about that and writing. But when I write about something, I might sound like really like clarity around it, but I might have sat with it for a week. So I actually writing it helped me figure it out. It just the process of that just became something that I did. And the stuff that you should do is the stuff where time just passes for you when you're doing it.
So what's your process like for writing that newsletter? Because I mean, they're not super long either. They're really like readable in like 3 minutes, you know, or less, I think. And they often include links to other valuable content. So what's your process?
The process is I keep a list of ideas. Oftentimes I don't get to it, or I get to it when something happened in the current event that ties to that idea, which seems to be a winning formula. Sunday, I pick a topic, write a draft on Sunday or Monday. I have a great editor who's sort of my sounding board. She will go through it, give me her feedback. Usually after 2 or 3 times, we've got the final draft. And then Tuesday, we pick an image. Wednesday, we set it up. It actually has to go out now, like literally right about now on Thursdays, because it's 7 a.m. around the world. So people in Australia start getting it in a couple hours on Friday. And it's just become this process. I don't even have any reminders. It's kind of a mental thing. That's like, get up and brush your teeth. It just happens now. I'm always worried I'm going to run out of ideas, but I haven't yet.
There's a couple that I actually was thinking about this morning. One was a recent one you wrote on love and hate.
Yeah.
And that was a really powerful one about the racist man who wasn't really actually racist at the end of the day, but lived where he lived, was around who he was around, and a rabbi moves into his community and he ends up calling him and you know, leaving racial slurs. And this guy chose to love him.
Yeah.
Right. It's super powerful. The rabbi, what's his?
He chose to call and leave messages on his answering machine for months, kind of encouraging him positivity and, you know, have a discussion. And, you know, you find that, you know, we talk about this a lot in our business. And otherwise, there's always a why, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a follow up to seek to understand that there's a why behind a lot of what people do. And if you can get by the generalizations, and if you can have a discussion, there's usually some pain there. You know, in that mm-hmm. case, this guy was a very angry neo-Nazi guy because he had an abusive dad, and all he ever knew was abuse and hate his whole life as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And through the process of just engaging with him, there was a tremendous amount of healing there.
Yeah, and look, we're in trouble now as a world, and everyone is painting the us and the them and the gross generalizations, and not even wanting to understand at all what anyone else is talking about, and just demonizing, and it's both the left and the right, and everyone.
Yeah, and it doesn't start that way, but what happens, and you wrote about it in another article, is this whole idea of respectful disagreement, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't, you don't start that way. But what ends up happening is we are naturally inclined. It makes us feel good when people agree with us. And so we surround ourselves with people like that.
Yeah. My example in the last Friday Forward was, you should understand why someone who grew up in poverty and whose parents were forced to work jobs below minimum wage would maybe be interested in socialism or some sort of societal wage equality, right? If they grew mm-hmm. up under that circumstance. Similarly, you might understand that someone, you know, whose family's business was taken away from a communist or socialist government might be very distrustful of the government and any of those policies. Like it's important to have those discussions and understand where the beliefs come from. You know, everyone is all over Ocasio-Cortez right now, but what I find interesting is, rather than demonizing her, if I were the Republicans, I'd be trying to understand where she is resonating with people. Even if you don't agree with her policies or think they're affordable or all the, you know, what, she's got 3 million followers on Twitter. She's got a lot of people listening to her. Right. What that's reaching some point of pain in some people or something they're resonating with. Even if you wanted to compete with her, I think you'd be better off trying to understand that. Mm-hmm. Then the more you demonize her, it seems like the more it makes people interested in her message.
Yeah, totally. And I think that one of the reasons there for that lack of conversation among all of those parties is because the distribution model for conversation in that world has been one way for so long, in terms of the major news media outlets, that people literally just speak so that they can create some sort of a soundbite or buzz that the media can then parse up and then use and spin around the world, and it just gets them talking about them. For example, another like not a political example, but another example that just came up in popular media recently was a Business Insider article that referred to one of the Jenner girls. The younger one, Kylie Jenner, I think is her name.
Yeah.
As a self-made billionaire, right? Like, and so like people got there. On one hand, there were people that were like celebrating it, right? On the other hand, there's people just going nuts that the media referred to as her as self-made, right?
Yeah.
And then the dialogue kind of just stops there and people just start bickering and arguing over just that thing, right? And there's no value there, right? But no. The value is going like deeper, like getting like seeking to understand people's positions.
Yeah, if I actually wanted to defeat someone, what I really would want to understand is what about them are people interested in or resonate? What pain are they? Rather than demonizing, and I think this is the story of the last election in some way too, and my politics are right in the middle. But I find it very interesting to watch both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Do the opposite, like sit down with that person and like understand why they're passionate about that. And if they have a ton of followers, clearly something they're doing is resonating with them. I would want to understand that just so I could go after those people.
Right. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And you know, I mean, it could be as simple as AOC and someone else and Ben Shapiro getting together and having a beer and like having just a normal human conversation like we're having, where it's okay to disagree and bicker, and it's part of the human experience, you know?
And it's probably more in common than they realize.
Than they realize, yeah. Well, you know, I know we're coming up on the top of the hour, so I want to respect your time, but I have four questions that I ask of every guest. And the first is, I want to make sure that we can send people to where they can connect with you online and look at your books and your great content that you generate.
Sure. So best place to find everything that I do is probably at robertglazer.com. So glazer.com. And by the time the show is launched, my podcast will be moved over to there too. You can get Friday Forward from there, but also if you're interested in signing up for Friday Forward, fridayfwd.com, or just Google Friday Forward and it'll come up, and that can be easier.
Awesome. Now, the first of the last three questions that everybody gets is, if you could pick any skill set that you currently possess, okay, so a skill you currently have, and dial it up to an 11 into a superpower, what would it be?
It's like architecture. Like I'm actually good at sort of design. We built our house and at like the basics because of the vision stuff. But when it gets down to like being more specific about what went together, sort of like interior design, that would be one I have the gross motor skill, but not the fine motor skill.
Interesting. That's a first. I've never heard anybody answer that. That's awesome. What are three lies that we tell ourselves that prevent us from realizing what we're fully capable of achieving?
I'm happy. Other people are responsible for my failures, and I'm doing the best I can.
Ooh. So I'm happy. Other people are responsible for my failures. And what was the last one again?
I'm doing the best I can.
Wow. Talk about the I'm happy thing for a second.
I think it's something, look, think about Facebook. Like usually the people most likely to get divorced are the ones professing their love to each other on Facebook and all that stuff. I just think that what really worry, like what are you projecting as the persona versus being really honest with yourself, whether you're happy about what you're doing or how you're doing it. We're so worried about how we project externally. Mm-hmm. These
days. My wife and I were actually having a conversation about the difference between happiness and joy just the other day, and that we're experiencing a lot of joy right now in our life, not necessarily happiness, but there is a distinction, and it's an important one because
there's a book out right now called Joyful that literally talks about this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And she said, I talked to the author 2 weeks ago, and she said that joy is a short-term emotion and happiness is more of a long-term state.
Interesting.
Like colors and shapes and stuff bring us like joy in the short term.
Interesting. I'll have to check that out. The last question comes from the title of a book by Clay Christensen called How Will You Measure Your Life? But I ask it in an interesting way. So give me your favorite art form.
Photography.
Okay. So you're 100 years old.
Yeah.
And you can't talk, but you've left a set of instructions for a photographer to come up with a piece that encapsulates the answer to that question. How will you measure your life? What would those instructions include and who would be in the picture?
My family, it would be pictures of the people's lives who I had improved or helped them build their capacity. So I sure hope my family is in that. But it would be probably other leaders or people that I had come across in my time, and somehow their interaction with me made their life better.
I love it. That's a beautiful answer. Have you seen one of those photography collages where the person's picture is actually made up of other people?
No. Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's like pixels. It's like pixels.
Picture. Yeah. Yeah. I've seen actually like a family picture made up of family pictures.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Well, Bob, thank you so much for joining us on the Impact Entrepreneur Show. It's been a blast getting to know you and learn a little bit more about what is going on behind the scenes.
Thanks so much, Mike. It was great chatting with you.
Thank you to this week's guest, and thank you for listening. If you missed any of the key points and highlights from my conversation, we've got you covered over at theimpactentrepreneur.net/podcast for show notes to each and every episode. And while you are there, check out Flynn Wealth Strategies and Insurance Solutions. You can do that by visiting flynnwealthstrategies.com. The Lawton Marketing Group and the Podcast Masters. We could not do this show without them and with all of their support. Now, until next time, go make an impact.